5 p.m. on Tuesday, May 17th, and you're listening to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Today, May 17th, 2022, is International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia, a day created in 2004 to draw attention to the violence and discrimination experienced by lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex people, and all other people with diverse sexual orientations, gender identities or expressions, and sex characteristics. The date of May 17th was specifically chosen to commemorate the World Health Organization's decision in 1990 to declassify homosexuality as a mental disorder. Today, May 17th, 2022, also happens to be the day that the municipality of Sainte-Adèle in Quebec is set to raise, for the first time and in an absurd act of pinkwashing, the pride flag in front of City Hall. What follows is a short communique from Friends of CKUT and an audio collage of public statements the municipality has made since 2017 regarding the Gay Falls, interspersed with sound bites of Gay Falls security telling queers that it's prohibited to walk side by side.
Voici un communiqué par le groupe qui a composé le collage auditif que vous êtes sur le point d'écouter. Profilage au chou de Sainte-Marguerite. La ville de Sainte-Adèle y sera aujourd'hui Journée internationale contre l'homophobie et la transphobie. Le drapeau arc-en-ciel sur le mât de la ville. Bien que nous saluons cette initiative, elle n'est pas suffisante pour réparer les torts causés à la communauté LGBTQ+, par la mairie. Au fil des 10 dernières années, la ville, en collaboration avec la MRC des Pays d'Arnon, la Sûreté du Québec et plusieurs firmes de sécurité, s'est attaquée par divers moyens à la présence de personnes LGBTQ+, aux chutes Sainte-Marguerite. En 2013, elle a démoli un pont parce qu'il, citation, « causait problème avec la communauté gay ». Fin de citation. En 2017, elle a orchestré des rafles policières parce que, citation, « les gays viennent depuis longtemps ». Fin de citation. Et ce, suite à une plainte déposée par Nadine Prière, alors conseillère municipale. La ville avait alors caché l'identité de la conseillère et parlé plutôt d'une, citation, « dame ». Fin de citation. Aujourd'hui, elle profile avec l'aide de gardiens de sécurité embauchés par la MRC des Pays d'Arnon, ceux qui souhaitent accéder au stationnement situé à proximité des chutes. En 2017, la ville s'était engagée, entre autres, à reconnaître, citation, « l'importance historique et actuelle du site pour les communautés LGBTQ+, fin de citation, et, citation, « à préserver l'accessibilité », fin de citation, du site. Plutôt que s'en tenir à ses promesses, elle a plutôt choisi de poursuivre son approche punitive, renouvelant, dès 2018, ses appels à la répression et profitant, en 2020, de la pandémie pour mettre en place sa fameuse guérite de contrôle guérite qui, mentionnons-le, avait été discutée en 2017 suite au rafle policier homophobe dans un contexte pré-pandémique. Rappelons que les chutes Sainte-Marguerite, connues anciennement sous le nom Parc de Sainte-Adèle et Parc des Chutes, sont situées sur des terrains publics cédés à la ville en 1960 et en 1998, citation, pour des fins de parcs touristiques, fin de citation, que la ville a pendant plus d'un demi-siècle vivement encouragé leur utilisation et que la privatisation progressive de ceux-ci n'a eu lieu qu'au moment où elle s'est décidée de faire disparaître les personnes LGBTQ+, des lieux. Considérant les événements recensés dans ce texte, nous attendons de la mairie plus qu'une levée de drapeau. Les excuses officielles envers la communauté LGBTQ+, sont de mise. Les bonnes intentions des représentants municipaux ne doivent pas se résoudre à une simple entreprise de pinkwashing. Il est plus que temps que la ville de Sainte-Adèle prenne ses responsabilités dans cette affaire en reconnaissant publiquement ses torts, en rendant aux personnes issues de la diversité sexuelle et de genre leur lieu de rassemblement, leur fierté et leur droit.
Les chutes Glen Wexford. Des terrains privés et non pas publics.
Moi, j'ai un projet que je vais introduire très prochainement.
La Sûreté du Québec est sur le dossier.
Peut-être que ça serait une solution de mettre une guérite.
Avec des gardes de sécurité.
Elle a été témoin d'un film pornographique qui se tenait là.
La Sûreté du Québec va faire des arrestations. Avisez votre entourage.
Le but de votre visite Interdit de marcher côte à côte. C'est un en arrière de l'autre.
Qu'est-ce qui soudainement devient un problème? Ben, c'est la nudité.
C'est un endroit extrêmement dangereux. Alcool, drogue.
Celle que vous venez d'entendre, elle s'appelle Nadine Brière.
Moi, j'ai un projet que je vais introduire très prochainement.
Le maire de Saint-Adèle, M. Robert Milo.
Sécurité.
Sécurité. Qu'est-ce qu'ils font là, maman?
Surveillance. Sécurité. Contrôle. Fameuse chute, là.
Sécurité. Qu'est-ce qu'ils font là, maman?
That was a communique and audio collage about queer phobia at the Gay Falls. It's Tuesday, May 17th, 2022, and International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, and Biphobia. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Stay tuned for some headlines, and then today's episode of Democracy Now!
First, some Montreal and Quebec news. Mask wearing is no longer mandatory in many public spaces, including schools, as of Saturday, May 14th. The province still requires masks in healthcare facilities, where vulnerable populations are at risk of exposure, and public transit, where social distancing is difficult to maintain. And Montrealers and members of the Ganawage Mohawk community marched against Provincial Bill 96 this Saturday morning. They met in front of Dawson College and marched in front of Premier François Legault's office. The proposed law would make Quebec's French language charter a top priority. Members of the National Assembly are expected to vote on Bill 96 this month. And a group of media organizations canceled their plans for a televised English language debate in preparation for this fall's provincial election. This cancellation comes after Premier Legault, leader of Coalition Avenir Québec, and Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon of the Parti Québécois turned down the debate invitation. The first and only televised English language debate among party leaders was in 2018. And Quebec Premier François Legault called on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to close the unofficial border crossing at Roxham Road south of Montreal. Legault says the province lacks the capacity to accommodate asylum seekers. Trudeau says that, quote, "We have an enormous border and we're not going to start arming or putting fences on it," end quote. And Canadians across the country witnessed a total lunar eclipse on Sunday night. The moon passed through Earth's shadow, the first time for Canadians since last May. And now for some news you can use. McGill's Schulich School of Music is having student exam recitals all month. These are free and open to the public, and you can attend in person or stream them online. For more information, visit the Schulich School of Music's website and click on the Events tab. And Milton Park community members are petitioning in favor of the permanent removal of a fence surrounding an empty lot at the corner of Milton and Park. Real estate company Goldman Co. Inc. put up the fence, which community members removed earlier this month. They want the lot to become a community space where unhoused people can stay. And the multidisciplinary art event, MTL Uncovered, is taking place at the end of the month. It will feature independent visual artists, musicians, and food vendors, all of whom are based in Montreal. The event is Sunday, May 29th at Théâtre Paradoxe. Visit the Uncovered Art Canada Facebook page for more information.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
You think about this race replacement theory that he talked about in this manifesto. There are people who are pushing this hatred on these young people, indoctrinating their minds to go out and commit violence.
President Biden's visiting Buffalo today, 2 days after an 18-year-old white supremacist killed 10 people at a supermarket in the heart of the black community. We'll speak to Rashad Robinson of Color of Change and Talia Levin, author of Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy.
So when you have a political movement that consistently portrays demographic change, specifically the change that white people will become a demographic minority in America as apocalyptic, and the mere presence and birth of non-white people as a threat, an existential threat. Those are the preconditions for violence. That's annihilatory rhetoric.
Plus, we look at monopolies and the baby formula shortage. As parents scramble to find formula to feed their babies across the United States, we'll look at how the crisis is linked to the fact that just 4 companies sell almost all the baby formula in the country. A whistleblower had warned about problems at Abbott's largest baby formula plant last October, but the FDA took months to interview the whistleblower, who was fired by Abbott. We'll speak to David Dayan of the American Prospect. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's visiting Buffalo today as families there mourn the victims of Saturday's massacre, when a white 18-year-old suspect killed 10 people at a supermarket he deliberately targeted in the city's black community. Investigators say the shooter spent months carefully planning his assault and intended to continue his rampage with an attack on a second location. Amidst the mourning, calls for justice are growing. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump spoke in Buffalo Monday.
What happened on Saturday was an act of domestic terrorism. And we have to define it as such. We can't sugarcoat it. We can't try to explain it away, talking about mental illness. No, this was an act of domestic terrorism perpetrated by a young white supremacist.
We'll have the latest on the Buffalo massacre after headlines. In California, officials in Orange County say Sunday's mass shooting at a church in Laguna Woods was a politically motivated hate crime targeting the Taiwanese community.
It is believed the suspect involved was upset about political tensions between China and Taiwan.
Police named the suspect 68-year-old David Cho of Las Vegas, a Chinese immigrant and U.S. citizen. He reportedly placed Molotov cocktails around the church and chained exit doors shut before opening fire on a congregation gathered for a luncheon. Dr. John Chang died in the assault. 4 others were rushed to the hospital with gunshot wounds. On Monday, Orange County officials hailed Dr. Chang as a hero who rushed the gunman, giving others a chance to subdue their attacker.
President Joe Biden has approved a Pentagon plan to redeploy up to 500 U.S. troops to Somalia. The move largely reverses a withdrawal ordered by then-President Trump during his final days in office. The Pentagon says the troops are needed to train Somalia's army to combat al-Shabaab militants. The Pentagon's announcement came just after Hassan Sheikh Mohammed was sworn in as Somalia's president, a post he previously held from 2012 to 2017. In news from Ukraine, more than 260 Ukrainian troops have been evacuated from the besieged Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol, ending a week-long standoff. About 50 injured Ukrainian fighters were taken to a hospital in the Russian-controlled town of Novoastok. The other fighters were taken to another town under Russian control. With the plant evacuated, Russia now controls all of Mariupol, which has been left in ruins after months of fighting. The standoff at the steel plant lasted 4 months. The U.S. Senate has voted to advance a $40 billion military and economic aid package for Ukraine by a vote of 81-11. The Senate agreed to limit debate on the bill, setting up its passage, which is expected on Wednesday. The entire Democratic caucus supported the measure. The 11 no votes came from Republicans, including Senator Rand Paul, who temporarily stalled passage of the $40 billion package last week. Paul accused Senate leaders of trying to ram through the spending bill without any oversight on how the money is being spent. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said Russia can accept Finland and Sweden joining NATO, but not if new military bases are set up in the two countries.
As for the expansion of NATO, including through new members of the alliance, Finland and Sweden, Russia wants to inform you that it has no problems with these states, none. And so, in this sense, there is no immediate threat to Russia from an expansion of NATO to include these countries. But the expansion of military infrastructure into this territory would certainly provoke our response. What that response will be, we will see what threats are created for us.
On Monday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan hinted he may block Sweden and Finland from joining NATO, but many analysts expect Turkey to back down in exchange for some concessions. Turkey's accused both countries of supporting the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is banned in Turkey. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has tested positive for COVID-19, is isolating at home with moderate symptoms. Ardern's government oversaw one of the world's most successful campaigns to stamp out the coronavirus until a wave of Omicron infections earlier this year forced New Zealand to abandon its zero COVID strategy. More than 80% of New Zealand's population is fully vaccinated, and the nation's per capita death rate from COVID is nearly 16 times lower than the U.S. In China, authorities say Shanghai has achieved zero COVID status after no new cases of community spread were detected for 3 consecutive days. This comes as a lockdown affecting some 25 million Shanghai residents is now in its 7th week. Public health restrictions across China this year have impacted hundreds of millions of people, driving the official unemployment rate to more than 6% in April. That's China's highest jobless rate since February 2020. Here in New York City, public health officials strongly recommended Monday people wear medical-grade masks indoors, but stop short of ordering a mask mandate. The warning came as New York prepared to raise its COVID alert level to high for the second time this month. Meanwhile, The New York Times reports the Food and Drug Administration's poised to authorize third-dose booster shots of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children age 5 to 11. Across the U.S., coronavirus hospitalizations are continuing to rise, with public health officials warning the nearly 100,000 new cases reported each day represents a significant undercount. The Supreme Court's conservative majority has sided with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz in a case challenging a federal anti-bribery law. Writing for the majority in Monday's 6-3 opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts ruled that the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech protects the right of a candidate to use unlimited post-election contributions to repay loans made to their campaign. The federal campaign finance law, known as the McCain-Feingold Act, previously capped such loans at $250,000. In her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote, quote, "The theory of the legislation is easy to grasp. Political contributions that will line a candidate's own pocket benefits given after his election to office pose a significant danger of corruption, she said. The Biden administration's easing Trump-era restrictions on travel between the United States and Cuba. The State Department said Monday it'll reinstate the Cuba Family Reunification Parole Program, expanding visa processing and making it easier for families to visit relatives in Cuba. The administration's also lifting a $1,000 cap on remittances family members can send to relatives in Cuba. The new measures fall short of U.S.-Cuban rapprochement seen under former President Obama. In occupied East Jerusalem, dozens of Palestinians were injured Monday as Israeli forces used rubber-coated steel bullets, tear gas and foul-smelling skunk water to attack a funeral procession of a Palestinian man killed by Israeli soldiers. On Saturday, Walid al-Sharif succumbed to wounds he suffered April 22nd when Israeli troops shot him in the head with a rubber-coated bullet as they fired so-called less lethal munitions at worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. An eyewitness said Israeli forces left al-Sharif bleeding for nearly half an hour before he was finally taken to the hospital in a coma. He's among 54 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the beginning of the year. Meanwhile, the Catholic Church's top official in Jerusalem has condemned Israeli police for their violent attack on last Friday's funeral for Shireen Abu Akleh. The veteran Al Jazeera journalist was killed last week covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank in an attack Palestinians and Al Jazeera blame on Israeli military snipers. Archbishop Pier Battista Pizzaballa said on Monday, Israel's attack on Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral was a severe violation of international norms and regulations.
The police stormed into a Christian health institute, disrespecting the church, disrespecting the health institute, disrespecting the memory of the deceased, and forcing the pallbearers almost to drop the coffin. Israeli police invasion and disproportionate use of force, attacking mourners, striking them with batons, using smoke grenades, shooting rubber bullets, frightening the hospital patients, is a severe violation of international norms and regulations.
In Lebanon, Hezbollah and its political allies have lost their majority in parliament after final results from Sunday's election showed no outright winner. The inconclusive outcome leaves Lebanon's parliament split among several camps, even as the nation grapples with soaring inflation, rampant poverty and corruption. It was Lebanon's first election since a devastating economic collapse in 2019 and the massive 2020 explosion at the port of Beirut that killed at least 215 people while destroying entire neighborhoods. Sri Lanka's newly sworn-in prime minister has warned his nation is down to a one-day supply of gasoline as a devastating economic crisis is set to deepen. Ranil Wickremesinghe said Monday Sri Lanka's government will have to print money to pay government wages, even though it'll lead to the devaluation of the currency. He said Sri Lanka will seek to privatize its state-owned airline and called on citizens to accept even deeper austerity measures.
The next couple of months will be the most difficult ones of our lives. We must prepare ourselves to make some sacrifices and face the challenges of this period. I have no desire to hide the truth and to lie to the public. Although these facts are unpleasant and terrifying, this is the true situation.
In recent weeks, Sri Lanka has been rocked by protests demanding the ouster of the president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, among rolling blackouts, soaring inflation and shortages for fuel, medicine and water. Back in the United States, the Biden administration's announced a number of steps to alleviate a critical nationwide shortage of baby formula. The Food and Drug Administration and Abbott Laboratories have reached an agreement to allow Abbott to reopen the nation's largest baby formula plant, which was closed after due to concerns over bacterial contamination following the deaths of two babies. Meanwhile, the FDA has eased import rules on baby formula made overseas, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has said babies as young as 6 months old can now be fed cow's milk for a brief period of time due to the baby formula shortage. Up until now, pediatricians had recommended babies not be fed cow's milk until they are 1 year old. We'll have more more on this story later in the broadcast. And the longtime LGBTQ lawyer and activist, Irva Shivad, has died at the age of 63. From 1989 to 1992, she headed the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and became an outspoken critic of the federal government's response to the AIDS crisis. In 1990, she interrupted a speech by President George H.W. Bush while holding a sign that read, "Talk is cheap, AIDS funding is not." She appeared on Democracy Now! In 2009.
I feel that, you know, as a woman of color, it's not really separable for me. Racial justice, gay rights, social justice, economic justice, they're intertwined. And the context that we live in requires, I think, the gay movement to see how intertwined our struggle is with the defeat of right-wing values and right-wing ideology.
To see our whole interview with Irva Shivad, you can go to our website. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we turn to the Buffalo Massacre as President Biden visits the city today. Stay with us. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden is visiting Buffalo today, meet with families mourning the victims of Saturday's massacre, when a white 18-year-old suspect killed 10 people at a supermarket in the heart of Buffalo's Black community. As families plan funerals, calls for justice are growing. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump spoke Monday alongside the son and daughter of the oldest victim, 86-year-old Ruth Whitfield.
There's nothing we can do that's going to take away the hurt, take away these tears, take away the pain, take away the hole in our hearts, because part of us is gone, senselessly taken from us by hate.
He took away my mother and my best friend. How dare you? How dare you? This needs to be fixed. ASAP.
Amen.
Mom, we love you. Thank you.
You think about this race replacement theory that he talked about in this manifesto. There are people who are pushing this hatred on these young people, indoctrinating their minds to go out and commit violence. I mean, these politicians who are trying to, you know, use fear to inspire their base, to help get cable news ratings. It's these people who are accomplices to this mass murder. And Cliff, even though they may not have pulled the trigger, they did load the gun for this young white supremacist. They loaded the gun. And we have to hold them accountable, too.
So that's Ben Crump. And before that, Robin and Garnell Whitfield. They lost Ruth Whitfield, the oldest at 86 of the victims in the massacre on Saturday. Garnell Whitfield is also the former fire commissioner of Buffalo. The Whitfield family and others may sue Bushmaster, the company that makes the assault-style weapon used in the Buffalo attack, which Crump, Biden and others are calling an act of domestic terrorism. The alleged gunman told investigators he was filled with hate toward Black people. His online record shows he'd been previously studying hate attacks. He posted a 180-page manifesto citing racist replacement theories and had the number 14 stenciled on the barrel of his gun, which is reportedly a reference to a 14-word white supremacist phrase. He live streamed the attack on Twitch, which our next guest tweeted about. Color of Change President Rashad Robinson tweeted, Twitch took down the live stream of the white supremacist shooting in Buffalo in under 2 minutes. Meanwhile, the video is now on Facebook with 1.8 million views, and they're not removing it because it doesn't violate their terms of service, Rashad says. Color of Change has called for social media platforms to institute changes to their terms of service in order to keep us safe, saying, quote, there is a direct through line between the tech industry's lack of regulation and the anti-black violence we saw in Buffalo. Rashad Robinson, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could start off by responding to what happened, and then most specifically, because we are seeing massacre after massacre, and of course, this one is so reminiscent of what happened at Mother Emanuel in South Carolina a few years ago, the targeting of the black community. We understand that the white supremacist teenager who did this had also considered schools and churches, but was afraid of security.
Well, I mean, for all of us, this is both incredibly sad, but it also makes us deeply angry because of all of the things that could be and should have been done to deal with the climate that fuels this type of violence. At the end of the day, whole incentive structure, a whole profit incentive structure, which has both incentivized the type of content and disinformation and hate-filled rhetoric that we see online. We have watched social media platforms refuse to deal with this because self-regulated companies are unregulated companies. I have went before Congress to try to push members of Congress to actually deal with the immunity that these platforms have over this type of content. And it's not simply about freedom of speech, Amy. This is about what they amplify. This is about the content that they serve up to users as they sign on. This is about all of the ways in which their product is designed in order to create people to have more time on these platforms, more engagement on these platforms, to be engaged in more hate-filled rhetoric. And at the end of the day, we are watching. We are seeing firsthand the impact of it. We should not have to go to billionaires to beg them to protect our civil rights. Our government should be doing the work to hold corporations accountable. And right now, they are not doing it. And at the end of the day, we live, exist in a climate. It's not just the social media platforms. It's also Fox News. It's also the ways in which the big carriers, cable carriers, the Verizons and Comcast of the world, pay more money for Fox News than they do for other cable programs. And so people should have a choice and should be able to not actually have Fox News. We should be able to drive down the profits of Fox News, but we can't because 90% of their money comes actually from carrier services, carrier fees, not from advertisers. So there's so much at stake here. But at the end of the day, what folks should recognize is that there is an incentive structure, there is a team, there are players, there are coaches, there are owners, and this killer did not act alone. He is part of a larger network, and until we deal with the incentive structure, we will see more of this.
And Rashad, could you talk about Twitch, the platform that many people are unfamiliar with that enabled the shooter to live stream this attack? Explain what the platform is and how we used it.
Well, Twitch is a platform that allows creators to post and engage platforms. It allows people to monetize in different ways their creativity. We've been actually running a campaign with Black Twitch creators because of all of the sort of hate attacks and the raids that have happened on their chats and on their channels. And what we've seen is an inability of Twitch to do anything about it. We've been back and forth with Twitch. We've demanded racial equity audits of Twitch. We have been engaged to try to push this platform to actually do better. And so for us, the engagement at Color of Change with Twitch did not start recently. We have been engaged. We have been warning Twitch. We have recognized how their platform was used and how it's become a home, a safe haven for the type of hate
for folks that actually know that they can engage in this type of behavior and not be held accountable. But at the end of the day, these platforms get to do it because they believe that they are protected. And in essence, they have been protected by a set of laws that actually give them, in some ways, immunity over being held accountable liably in all sorts of ways. And so until we actually deal with the incentive structures, until we create more accountability over the algorithms, and I know folks are wondering, like, this technology is so complicated. Well, we've had complicated things over time. And what folks should recognize as we think about sort of what does it mean to regulate these companies? What does it mean to hold these companies accountable? Our cars are not safe. Our seatbelts don't work because of the benevolence of the auto industry. They work because there is government infrastructure and regulation. And there are consequences when those things do not work, when standards are not met. Right now, folks can go out to Silicon Valley, call themselves engineers, and build all sorts of things without any rules or regulations or accountability for what they build. And so right now, the technology that should be bringing us into the future and bringing us in together is dragging us into the past. And it's doing that not as an accident, but because we have a set of rules or a lack of rules that are manufacturing all of the things that we're seeing.
But Rashad, I wanted to ask you, how do you draw the line between being able to regulate these companies and at the same time allow for legitimate dissent and for dissent not to be not to be closed down by these companies at the same time? I'm thinking, for instance, even now with the situation with Elon Musk taking over Twitter, and he's going in the opposite direction, insisting on more freedom on these platforms.
Well, people use the word freedom, and it only means freedom for some, right? If the ability of certain people in our communities to be able to go to a grocery store or to go to a church is diminished because of a climate for profit that is created, that actually doesn't make us more free. But, you know, to the extent that we're not talking about here about whether or not someone should be able to post things that we may not like or we might find distasteful. What we are talking about is algorithmic amplification. We are talking about how these platforms put energy behind making some type of content travel because that type of content creates more energy. So an example is on Facebook. If Facebook tomorrow decided that they were going to just make it so you spent more time looking at your friends and family, even if your friends and family are sometimes sharing things that are distasteful, that would diminish greatly the type of content that is hate-filled. But in fact, what they are incentivizing is us all being part of groups where people are arguing because or if we see a piece of content and maybe engage in it, even if we don't join that group, it gets served up to us. And what we know is that this is all part of the larger scheme at these platforms to keep us on the platforms longer, to keep us engaged there longer because it drives up their profits. And they can do that because at the end of the day, that they don't actually have accountability. So now imagine a company that produces meat saying that, you know what, we just want to give consumers more choice. So we're going to put some meat on the supermarket counters that's actually safe, and we're going to put some that, you know, is a couple of months old. And, you know, you pick, we just want to give people choice. Those companies would be held accountable. What we are dealing with is not simply, you know, these ideas of what people are posting. What we are dealing with is the back-end business models that are creating a structure where certain things are being able to be profited from, certain things travel differently, and hate-filled content has more of a space to be engaged with. And that's what we are talking about. If these companies had a level of accountability, you better believe that the innovators in Silicon Valley would figure out how to engage. I think that there is this idea that regulation and accountability stifles innovation. But what we know is that climate innovation has helped in so many ways give us new types of vehicles and new types of ways to actually move from place to place. Innovation can both make us safe and it can actually spark or regulation can make us safe and help us be more innovative. And that's what we have to focus on. But at the end of the day, none of us should have to rely on Mark Zuckerberg or Twitch, which is owned by Amazon, or all of these companies to actually decide whether or not they're going to keep us safe, and to balance that up against their growth and their profit, because they will always choose their growth and profit over our lives, because they've proven it time and time again.
Rashad, we're going to bring in a second guest to join you right now. Rashad Robinson, of course, is with Color of Change. Saturday's massacre by the 18-year-old white supremacist, which killed 10, has been called a made-for-the-internet massacre. And the shooter streaming the massacre on Twitch for about 2 minutes, as Rashad pointed out, it's owned by Amazon before Twitch took it down. Users of hate-filled online message boards like 4chan soon shared the video. It was being watched by 22 people, and now it's been watched by millions. For more, we're joined by journalist and author Talia Levin, who spent nearly a year impersonating right-wing white supremacists online, assuming false identities to infiltrate their groups, as she worked on her book Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. Talia, welcome to Democracy Now! In the process of writing your book, you also explored the relationship between the extreme right and conservatives in the United States, in the mainstream, which you write about in your new piece for Rolling Stone, headlined, "The Buffalo Shooter Isn't a Lone Wolf. He's a Mainstream Republican." Take us through your response to what happened and your journey through the dark web. But as you said, it doesn't just exist there in 4chan and 8chan and the Dylann Roof groups, those who praise the killer and the Mother Emanuel Church and others. Take us on that journey you took.
I mean, I think it's important to note that the shooter was radicalized, according to his, his manifesto and other writings, anyway, online. He was steeped in this ecosystem, which I know pretty well, unfortunately. I would say that it exists in parallel to and has grown ever closer to what I call the sort of white-hot center of Republican politics. And the commonality is this fixation on white dominance, this fixation on white fertility, this, the demographics of the United States are changing. It has been clear for some time now that there will be a time, that is drawing closer, just due to the sort of fluctuation of births and deaths and some level of immigration, though that's been, consistently restricted, where the U.S. will be a majority-minority country, no longer a, quote, white country. And to me, it's important to note that demographic change in and of itself is a moral neutral. But it has been the subject of this moral panic, this intense moral panic, this imputation of existential threat. Both in the extremist white supremacist movement and now increasingly over the past half decade throughout the Republican Party, to the point where it is really a consuming sentiment in the central institutions of the Republican Party and its media arms. So, you have this logic of sort of an existential struggle for survival of the white race that's utterly consumed the top line, of the Republican Party, and also is the central preoccupation of far-right extremists who do not claim Republican affiliation, far from it. They consider themselves outside the two-party system, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, to me, it was striking, how closely the shooter's rhetoric mirrored that of stuff we're seeing from Republican officials and candidates and right-wing pundits.
I wanted to ask you about the youthfulness of some of some of these killers perpetrating these massacres. I mean, Dylann Roof was 21 when he engaged in the Charleston massacre. Patrick Wood Crucius in El Paso in 2019 was 21. Now this shooter, 18. Your experience in terms of the impact on young people of these neo-Nazi and ultra-right replacement theory views?
Yeah, I also wanted to just, while I have a megaphone, like, talk about what replacement theory is. It's also known as, like, the white genocide theory. It's this idea that, you know, again, it takes this idea of demographic change, and instead of positing it as morally neutral, talks about, you know, or sort of like the natural ways populations change over time, postulate that it's a, you know, a sinister plot being engineered, you know, and the white supremacists will explicitly say that they believe it's engineered by Jews. That was the direct motivation of the Pittsburgh synagogue shooter. Whereas mainstream Republicans will talk about quote unquote elites or globalists or, you know, Democrats, right? For electoral advantage. But the sort of conspiracy element of it is that this is a deliberately engineered and sinister and nefarious demographic change. As to the youthfulness of the perpetrators, I mean, I think it's important to understand white supremacist extremism as like any other human endeavor. It's driven by narrative, it's driven by emotion and story. So, you know, what it appeals to emotionally, you know, and it often sort of is perpetuated in these youth-oriented online spaces. You know, that's it sort of pitches itself as very edgy, this ideology. You know, the mechanisms it uses for recruitment are sort of these edgy jokes that aren't really jokes. crude machismo, the sort of ability to engage in sort of online harassment and cruelty, you know, without compunction, right? But the story that it tells is very much a story in which, you know, you can be a hero, you can fight for the white race, you can belong to something bigger, your life can have a purpose. You know, if you take up arms, if you spill blood for the white race, you'll be a hero. You'll be a saint is the term they regularly use for white supremacist mass shooters. And that was the term that, you know, Peyton Gedrin, the Buffalo shooter, also employed in his online writings and describing, you know, previous perpetrators of massacres. So, you know, when you think about who does this sort of like dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, like, you know, it is good and sweet to die for your race, say, who does this rhetoric appeal to? You know, I think it's natural that it would appeal in the most actionable way, you know, to young men. Who are more prone to take up a call to arms.
So, Talia, I wanted to interrupt for a second to ask you, because what I was so struck by in Culture Warlords and your really deeply researched book, personally researched, I mean, you were so well-known on Twitter before this. You were at Media Matters. You've been monitoring the extreme right. You were the target of so much vitriol, you know, online. You were threatened with rape endless times, yet your bravery in staying there, also adopting a new persona. But I think so many people don't even understand what 4chan and 8chan are. He said he was so influenced, this shooter, by 4chan. And even though the Amazon company Twitch, only 22 people were viewing, very soon at 4chan, they took it up, even though it was replaced by, it was removed by Twitch. And now millions are viewing this. Those places you went to, not to say it all lives there now because the swamp has become mainstream, but take us there to the Dylann Roof groups, even today.
Yeah, I mean, these spaces, you know, you have your, like 4chan, There's certain communities on Discord. At this point, a lot of it has migrated to an app called Telegram, which is an encrypted messaging app that enables, you know, sort of public channels, private channels, the posting of video and audio. And so it's a very useful, mechanism to spread propaganda. One way I describe these online spaces is sort of perpetual motion radicalization machines. They are essentially megaphones for stochastic terror that operate 24 hours a day, you know, where people who are already radicalized or in the process of becoming radicalized can imbibe propaganda, can imbibe video of violence, can imbibe, you know, all kinds of racist screeds, including those from decades and centuries past. You know, they're passing PDFs of Mein Kampf and the Turner Diaries and these other radicalized texts. You know, they're constantly spreading racist memes. So it's really, once you have sort of entered these spaces, you are then subject to sort of this gushing, consistent fountain of vitriol that, you know, slowly, like any other form of propaganda, you know, shapes your worldview. It shapes an apocalyptic worldview, a worldview, you know, that again, just like consistently posits the necessity for violence over and over again, 24 hours a day. I mean, it's really remarkable how relentless the surge of propaganda is, you know, when you enter these spaces. And the function, you know, the reason why these videos, the same was true of the Christchurch mosque shooter. You know, his live streamed video of his massacre was, you know, taken down, by millions. You know, because these videos have significant propaganda value. You know, the visceral thrill of sort of almost in a video game like way watching people die. This has significant propaganda value, and every time an attack is successful and widely publicized, it lowers the barrier for the next one.
I'd like to bring in Rashad Robinson again. Rashad, you've had numerous conversations with some of these tech company executives. Could you talk about your discussions with them about this issue of racism and white supremacy and hate speech online? What's their response? And what do you think needs to be done concretely in coming months and years to address this problem?
Well, you know, my conversations oftentimes with them starts with them being, you know, deeply concerned, feeling very bad about the situation, saying that they're working hard, and oftentimes recognizing that there are people inside of these platforms who are working hard, who are trying sort of at the edges and even, you know, within very challenging circumstances to fix these problems. The challenge is the model itself. And even while these folks will say that they care and they want to work, they're unwilling to actually deal with the business model because they are not forced to. And so, you know, some of the hardest conversations we had with the social media platforms were in the summer of 2020, for instance, when Donald Trump posted that call to arms against protesters, the looters and shooters post on Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, it absolutely violated the four corners of the policies we had fought to put in place at Facebook. But instead of actually enforcing that policy against Donald Trump, Mark Zuckerberg calls Donald Trump to have a conversation with him and ends up leaving up that post. And when I ended up having a conversation with Mark going back and forth about it, they couldn't really sort of describe why they gave Donald Trump sort of an out, except to talk about it as sort of newsworthy. When, you know, trying to help them understand the history of vigilante violence, trying to help them understand the attacks on Black communities, trying to help them understand the calls to arms, made us once again recognize all of the ways in which the sort of attempts to get these companies to self-regulate are sort of futile. We actually need very clear rules, right? The algorithms should be more transparent at these companies. Government should be able to review them. We should actually understand what type of things get amplified and what type of things don't. There should be some sort of transparency. Researchers should have access to how these things work so that we can evaluate and we can find out if they're safe. These companies shouldn't have carte blanche. There are a whole set of things on the transparency front. Then there are a whole set of things on the business model front, from the ways in which targeted ads work on these platforms to the ways in which everything from recommendations. You go onto Twitter now and you maybe come across a white supremacist on Twitter, someone like Richard Spencer, who right now is still able to monetize on Twitter. And then you start getting served up more and more white supremacists, more and more white nationalists to actually follow. This is a design function at Twitter. This is choices they have made. These are choices that these platforms have made. And time again, they've been pushed and challenged on them. And they have chosen to do something different because the accountability, the consequences are not strong enough for them to do something different.
I want to thank you for being with us, Rashad and Talia. Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, and Talia Levin, author of Culture Warlords. Next up, we look at monopolies and the baby formula shortage with David Dayan of the American Prospect. Stay with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. With a nation facing a critical shortage of baby formula, we look now at the role of monopolies. The Biden administration's announced plans to alleviate the crisis as the Food and Drug Administration and Abbott Laboratories says it's reached an agreement to allow Abbott to reopen the nation's largest baby formula plant. The plant had been closed due to concerns over bacterial contamination months after a whistleblower alerted the FDA to alleged safety lapses and then was fired. Multiple babies became sick after eating formula from that plant. Two babies died. Meanwhile, the FDA has eased import rules on baby formula made overseas, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has said babies as young as 6 months old can now be fed cow's milk for a brief period of time due to the baby formula shortage. And until recently, pediatricians had recommended babies not be fed cow's milk until they're at least a year old. This is White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responding Monday to questions about the shortage.
Throughout the weekend, we've been working closely with manufacturers and retailers to identify transportation and logistical needs to increase the amount and spread of FDA-approved formula being shipped into the country and ensure that formula is quickly moving from factories to retailers. The president understands. He gets this. He gets how stressful it is for parents trying to feed their children, which is why we're leaving no stone unturned.
For more, we're joined by David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. He writes about the four companies that sell almost all baby formula in the United States. In his new piece, headlined "The Age of Rationing, From Pandemic Supply Chain Snarls to Baby Formula Shortages," we forgot that physical production isn't magic and we need to engineer it for stability. So let's start with this real catastrophe right now for parents with babies across the country. And the whole issue of monopoly, starting with the whistleblower who alerted the company and the FDA. And the response? The whistleblower was fired. Two babies die. We're talking about months ago before we got to this point where the shelves are bare for everyone.
Yeah, the whistleblower first alerted the company internally and then alerted the FDA. This was way back last October. This facility in Sturgis, Michigan, produces about 20% of the nation's supply of formula. So obviously, if you take that offline, you're going to have a problem. It's magnified even more by the market structure and the way that formula is sold. But just alone, if you take one out of every five boxes of formula off the shelves, while this is investigated, you're going to have a problem of getting supply into the places that you need.
And David, Dayan, how did we get to this point that four companies. It seems almost every major industry in America today, there's three or four companies that monopolize or control the supply. How did we get to this point in terms of baby formula?
Yeah, I would argue it's even worse in the baby formula industry. There are really two large conglomerates, Abbott Labs, which makes Similac and also, you know, produces medical devices, and Reckitt Benckiser, which is the creator of Enfamil, the other major brand. And they're mostly known for making Lysol. They're a UK company that makes a whole bunch of consumer goods. They're really the giants. About two-thirds of the market is in the hands of those two companies. Nestle, through the Gerber brand, and Perrigo, which makes store brands, they have a little sliver. But the reason is that we have a program called Women, Infants, and Children, the WIC program. And about half of all formula passes through that program.
Books invites you to our book launch event.
Confronting Canada's Past and Europe's Forgotten Revolutions.
Happening on Sunday, May 22nd, featuring the authors and editors of
Stand on Guard for Whom?
The Fire That Time.
Insatiable Hunger.
The Forgotten Revolution.
And Black Ukraine Yesterday and Today.
Join us on live stream or in person at 2 p.m.
at the Cité des Hospitalières, 251 Pine West. Corner Park.
Free tickets are available at blackroselaunch.eventbrite.ca or visit blackrosebooks.com for more information.
This event is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitaliers en Transition and CKUT-FM.
CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.